Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, you know, Tom Ray visits a lot of radio stations, and he sees a lot of problems. He's a consultant and an alternative broadcast inspector. What does that mean? We're going to tell you about the possibility of towers falling down and what you should do about it. Twirt is brought to you by Lavvo, providing seamless integration of your work processes and the uncomplicated operation of complex technology. See Lavvo in your future at lavvo.com/twirt. By BSW, broadcast supply worldwide, where the remote sale is on. Save on headsets and remote packages at bswusa.com. And by the Telos Alliance and the new OmniVolt audio processor. More processing power in one rack unit than others give you in three. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. Kirk Harnack here, along with Chris Tobin, your host for the show. We're at the 358th episode, so that's pretty good. We've been doing this a while and covered all kinds of topics about radio broadcasting, microphones, speakers, RF, light bulbs. And speaking of I always talk about the light bulb at the top of the tower. It's actually not in my office right now. I'm actually refurbishing it, at least to some degree. It was in terrible shape, and so it wouldn't even light up anymore. The wires were all brittle, and the insulation just fell off, and be pretty dangerous, I suppose. So I fixed some of the glass, cleaned the glass up, put parts of it in the dishwasher, and hopefully it may be a few weeks because I've got some out-of-town work to do. So anyway, the light bulb at the top of the tower is gonna come back. We'll have it here, I promise. In the meantime, you'll have to make do with the red on-air light here. So our show today, Tom Ray started out with our show for the first couple of years as a regular co-host. Well, Tom's been really busy with his own business, doing a lot of consulting, and he has found just enough time to join us today and talk about something that he's just mad about. We'll get to that in just a minute. Chris Tobin, let's bring him in here for the show. Chris, in somewhere in New Jersey. How you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing well. Yes, I'm in a performance studio here at a radio station, the jazz station, and that's a Hammond C3 organ that's behind me. It's pretty cool. The Leslie 120
wow.
speaker. So those of you who know the organs know very well what it is, and it's a unique sound. I had the pleasure of hearing it again this week, and we have a few artists that come through here quite often that love playing it, so it's great.
You know, I see Hammond organs in a couple of different scenarios. One is like you have there. They're a baby. They're in a temperature-controlled, humidity-controlled atmosphere. They're in a studio. The intention is to keep them around a long time, and that's great. And same thing for those in other recording studios, too. You've got a recording studio essentially there, but I see them babied like that. Then I also see them in some performance venues where the Leslie speaker is getting beer spilled on it. It's a shame, but, it just keeps on cranking. And I guess when it dies, they call the Leslie guy out and he fixes it.
Oh, yeah. Well, as long as if the cabinet's intact, the speaker's relatively mm-hmm. protected, so you're mm. okay with the beer spills. Actually, probably adds a little extra sound to it, so it's good.
The house, my office is at home, so the house that I'm in right now, when we bought this house, coming up on 12 years ago, when we bought this house, it came with a Hammond organ. I kid you not. It wasn't the C3. It was a Hammond something else. I forget what it was. It looks just like the one you had. It had the foot pedals. It had the dual keyboards, dual ranks. What do you call that? And what it didn't have was the Leslie speaker. The person who sold us the house didn't know what it was, and they threw it away because they could. They could get it out of the house. The organ itself, they couldn't move. It was too heavy, and so they left it in the house and said, "We're sorry about that." So I checked into, here in Nashville, well, the power supply and the speaker together, right? In that same cabinet?
Yes.
Yeah. So I went around to a few places in Nashville where they repair Hammond organs because there's a business for that here in Nashville, recording industry. Some of them go on the road and they come back and they need repair and adjustment. And the cost to repair it was going to be astronomical. So what I did was I donated it. It belongs now to the Country Music Hall of Fame. And I don't know if they have it on display or not, because who owned it before me was Otis Blackwell. That's whose house I live in. Otis wrote songs. Yeah, Otis wrote Love Me Tender, Don't Be Cruel, Great Balls of Fire, Handyman that James Taylor made famous. He wrote most of those before he moved to Nashville. But Otis wrote over 1,000 songs, and that his Hammond organ was here in the house. And anyway, now it's in the hands of the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I haven't kept up with it, so I need to see what that is. How about that? I'm glad you showed that to us, though. Thank you.
Nothing like this. And you have to start it up, get the speaker spinning. There's a whole process.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. Yeah, it's like, oh, you feel like you're starting a Model T. It's like, okay, first switch, you hold the switch in place, and once that switch is on, you wait a few seconds, then you flip the next switch, and then
contact.
It comes alive. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, you can always tell somebody who's never been behind one before when they can't seem to get it to go, and like, it doesn't seem to work. It's like, oh, hang on. Flip this switch, do this switch, and all of a sudden it comes alive. It's great.
And it doesn't have a button for demo mode like all the keyboards at the music store do, right? Boom, chick, chick, no. Boom, chick, chick, boom. It doesn't have
that,
right?
There's no demo mode. I love this device, this musical instrument, and I know how to play it, and I'll learn it quickly. Yeah. Maybe I'll move the camera later and we'll go over and give it a start and see what happens.
That would be a great counterpoint to the saddening and maddening topic at hand from the show today. So let's get through the rough stuff first, and then we'll get to the happy organ there at your radio station. You're at WBGO, right?
Yes.
Okay, very cool. All right, hey, enough ado about organs. Let's bring in Tom Ray. Tom, welcome in, buddy. Glad to see you.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, Kirk. And I'm a little echoey. I wasn't quite expecting the call, so I'm not really set up here. And I just, this does look fine. Okay, I am straight. I'm backwards when I'm looking at myself coming in here. But so wait a minute. Now, you have a tower light, and you put parts of it in the dishwasher, and you're still allowed in the house?
Yes, I did. My wife wasn't home. She had to work late that night. But hey, when the dishwasher fails, guess who has to clean it out anyway?
That's true. Whoops.
Yeah.
That wasn't good.
So,
sorry.
Yeah. So,
wow.
So, Tom, we're going to take our first break here, but give us the little teaser elevator speech about what we're going to be hearing about. You're mad as hell, and you're not going to take it anymore about towers, right?
Well, you know, I have a lot of stations that I do contract work for. I've got a bunch that I consult for. And the condition of some of the towers out there is actually frightening. It really is.
And yep, and that is what we're going to talk about, and maybe how engineers can try to make sure to the best of their ability that doesn't happen by explaining some of the real dangers that maybe tower owners, station owners haven't really thought about, including death. So hang on, we're gonna lawsuits and stuff like that. So we're gonna get to all those gory details here coming up in just a minute. Hey, our show This Week in Radio Tech with Chris Tobin and Tom Ray is brought to you in part by our friends at Lavo, LAWO.com. And when you go to their website, please stick in the /twert at the end of that. We'll get credit and you'll be taken immediately to the page you want to see. Lavo, LAWO.com/twert. It takes you to their radio on air page. And I say that because Lavo makes a lot of things. My goodness, they make big, huge audio production consoles like the MC36 and the MC66 and even the MC96. Or the MC squared 96. They have audio routers, big ones. They have video processing and core infrastructure, all kinds of SNMP and other control VSM and the wall and a product called Soul. You get the idea. They're a big company. They make a lot of big audio stuff, but they also make a whole line of products for radio. And that's what you're looking at right now. If you're following along at home on the screen there, let's start out. They have radio consoles that are just so slick and intuitive to use. They're designed to support you in the creation, preparation, and broadcast of your radio programs. Quick, efficient, intuitive work, guaranteed with lots of built-in cool stuff. Virtual radio. Now, that's the console that we talked about for a long time, the crystal clear console. That's where the console actually exists, at least the controls exist on a multi-touch touchscreen. Everything's sized for your fingers, so it works really well, very intuitive. And if you need to move, guess what? The infrastructure, that is the audio I/O box with the DSPs in it and all that, that stays in one place. But you can go on the air from other rooms, other locations, by having a network connection back to the DSP box. They also have routing systems. Reliable transfer of audio and data 24 hours a day, 355 days a year. A lot of that is based on the Ravenna standard, also AES-67 compatible there. The new Relay product is virtual radio It's pretty. Click on that link and go look at Relay. That is cool. But the newest console they just introduced at last year's IBC. It's the Ruby console. It's a whole new way of thinking about radio workflow. Now this is where physical and on-screen multi-touch controls combine to give your talent a really new way to create. Very powerful, really slick. You want to check all this out. If you click on a number of these, for example, the virtual radio button, you can go watch some videos on how this stuff works. One of those videos is hosted by Mike Dosh. He takes you through virtual radio and just what that looks like, how that works. Just an amazing array of stuff. And if you're a broadcaster like the BBC, like NPR, like Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you're already familiar with Lavo consoles and Lavo reliability. German engineered, amazing stuff, and just built to be simple to use and make you sound great on the air at the same time. Thanks a lot to Lavo at lavo.com/twort for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Really appreciate it. All right, let's jump right back into it. Now, Chris Tobin and Tom Ray probably don't cross paths a whole lot. They're both in the same general part of the world, but there's a lot of broadcasting going on around there. And so Tom and I were talking earlier today about the frustration and anxiety that comes with the condition of some towers in their area that Tom is familiar with. Chris has probably seen some scary ones too. But Tom, why don't you give us a little overview of what you're seeing out there, and then we'll talk about the specific risks involved. And I mean, what's an engineer to do when a tower he doesn't own could be a real problem?
Well, first things first. One of the many things I do is I'm the alternative broadcast inspector for New York State Broadcasters Association. So I go out, I inspect stations, do an FCC-style inspection. They get a three-year reprieve from the commission coming in. And, part of that is looking at the tower. And believe it or not, I have an FAA color chip, so I can actually tell you if your tower is the correct shade of orange. And you have to look at that, and you have to – one of the judgments is if you stand back, a couple of streets away and take a look at the tower, can you delineate orange, white, orange, white? One of the other things is when you're up near the tower, can you see bare metal? And I'm astounded at the amount of people who let the tower just sit there and rot. They won't paint the tower. They don't want to paint the tower. I have one client right now who's got a tower that no tower crew will go up. They'll come out, they'll cut the guy wires and drop the tower, but they will not go up that tower. It's dangerous. Matter of fact, in my neck of the woods over in Rockland County, New York, there was a tower that came down recently that had rotted and had been ignored. Tower crew went to look at it, and they actually pushed a pencil through the leg. So
wow.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, walking up, and they backed up and went, no, we're not doing this. 2 weeks later, one of the guy wires snapped. The tower bent over and came down. So what used to be a four tower array is now a three tower array. But you know, it's like, yeah, painting costs money. It does. It costs a lot of money. But it's not just to make the tower visual. Think about your house. If you don't paint your house, if you don't paint, let's say you have iron or steel banisters on either side of your front steps. If you don't paint those, after a while they're going to rust, and they're going to rot, and you're going to have to pull them out, and putting them back in can be a bear. You may have to redo part of the stairs because you won't be able to mount them because the old mounting is, stuck in place. And it's the same thing for a tower, except that the tower is a lot taller, weighs a lot more, and if that puppy comes down, you're off the air. There's a whole bunch of liability involved. If somebody gets hurt, if there's property damage that's not your property, and if it's a known condition, it's one thing if a plane were to hit the tower. It's one thing if a guy wire were defective and it snapped. But if it's a known condition, an insurance company may not cover that, and the whole dime comes out of your pocket as far as the station goes.
Wow, wow. Yeah. You know, if of course, on the other hand, it doesn't do any good to paint over rust either. So you kind of got to take care of your tower maintenance before the thing starts turning to rust or things get bad. Talk to me about tower inspections. In other words, let's say that I'm trying to do things right. I try to budget the money. I mean, if it needs painting, I'll do it. How do I get a good feel, though, for are there problems with my tower? Are there things up high where I can't see them that are rusting? Maybe there's some bolts that weren't stainless. Maybe there were some things that weren't galvanized very well. In other words, I feel like I'm at the mercy of a tower climber, and I don't want bad news. It's kind of like putting off a procedure like, oh, I don't know. I hate to put this in such terms, but kind of like putting off a colonoscopy, right? Because you don't want to know what could be wrong. Is that a little bit like some people treat their towers?
I think so. And the way to, there's a couple of ways you can go through it to get a rough general idea. I've been following your Facebook page, and I've been following your drone. So you could fly your drone up to take a look at parts of the tower, but that's not going to tell you the whole story. What you should do is hire a qualified tower company, have them go up, have them photograph the problems, tell you what the problems are, and suggest how to fix them. If you've got a cross member that's starting to rot out, they can replace that, and they can tell you what it's going to cost to replace it. So a lot of the companies will, if the tower is in reasonable shape, they can wire brush it, they can clean it off. There's a compound they can put on to seal the rust, and then they can paint the tower, and you'll get some more years out of it. So, the only real way to do it is to send a qualified crew up, and not your brother-in-law who likes to climb towers. You have to send a real tower company up and have them go through things and have them look at the towers and have them photograph it and have them bring it down and actually put together a full report. Because I'm finding that a lot of insurance companies these days want to see that report, and they want proof that the tower was inspected before they'll cover it.
Chris Tobin, you're in an area of the world where, my imagination is everybody takes really good of their towers. I mean, you're in the number one market in the country. But something tells me you're going to say, no, Kirk, it's not always people doing everything right. What's your opinion, Chris, on tower maintenance in the New York City area?
Well, I mean, I can say for the New York City folks, they definitely take care of their towers and don't let things go too far. As Tom pointed out, insurance companies tend to get a little spinnickety, about these things. But I will say, out in the farther reaches of the New York Metro, I have worked at many a place where, as Tom pointed out, the bare metal could be seen sometimes from the roadway, not just 10 feet from the tower itself. or obstruction lighting, the beacon may be working. Well, one of the two bulbs. And then there's the obstruction lighting that sometimes is either completely out or one of them is out, so you can't see it from all sides of the tower. Let's see, what was the other times I've had a few? Yeah, there's been a few things. what was the other one? Yeah, one site I was at was a guy anchors were not protected by some type of fencing, so you could walk up to it and create harm. Another site didn't have the registration signage, plus didn't have RFR notices. It was a site that was really loaded down. Cellular service, I think it was 2 FMs. There was some other stuff up there. And I know this had to be a problem because when I drive up, my car door opener and car alarm would fail to function if I got within about 20 feet of the site. So that gives you an idea of the amount of RF at the ground level of this. I think it was a 400-foot tower. So, there's a lot of things. That's a subtlety. I mean, is it a dangerous tower? Is it a bad tower? No, but it gives you an indication of what's going on. If you don't have signage that says, hey, this area may exceed certain RFR regulations, or, this area is, doesn't have a registration sign. You got to look at these things. And Tom knows exactly what I'm talking about, and I'm sure he's seen plenty of it.
or haven't seen plenty of it, whatever the case may be.
Right, exactly. Well, the classic is AM sites that people neglect, and they don't realize that neglecting the site is first safety, second just violates everything there is about your signal. So if you're complaining about coverage, that's probably one of the reasons. And then the other thing is that it's just it's just absolutely dangerous with some of these AM sites and the condition they're in. You're like, okay, I don't know about this, but I feel RF running through something. Yeah.
And so you're saying that letting the weeds grow up around the in the ground system and actually having trees in the ground system is a bad thing?
Oh, well, yeah. The weeds growing up along the base of the driven your directional array and your driven towers is the hot tower, and the grass is growing and touching it. And every so often you get this Viswar trip, and you don't know why, and you go out to the site. Everything looks normal, so to speak. And then one day is several days of no rain, very dry, arid temperature conditions, and suddenly you get a phone call from the local fire department that there's a small brush fire at the base of your tower, and you need to take care of it. We're on our way. Now all of a sudden you got a fire department on their way to your tower site, and they're about to spray water on your 20-kilowatt, 50-kilowatt, or 10-kilowatt tower, the base of it, that is, and you know, that's little things like that. Yes. Now, I say this because I can tell you that I know for a fact over the years there have been two situations here in the New York metropolitan area where such a thing has happened. So as a result of a lack of proper landscaping, I'll call it.
Now, there is something.
In the New Jersey Meadowlands, those aren't small brush fires because the reeds that grow up there are called Phragmites. They could be sitting in a puddle of water, but they're dry as a bone. Boy, all you have to do is make one spark, and those things go up, and you can see the smoke for miles.
Ooh.
Oh, yes. I've witnessed it years and years ago in the Meadowlands. The Phragmites, I was looking at – went to a site. A friend of mine called me up in a panic, and he's like, but they're in water, and they're burning. Is there somebody throw gas on them? I was like, no. That's just nature at its best. You need to control it real fast. Because when I got on site, they were burning – just 10 feet from the transmission line that was going back to the transmitter building. I'm like, dude, we got to get something fast. You got any weed whackers, you know, the sickles? Let's cut them down. At least we get them from catching fire to the wooden frame that supports your transmission line.
Oh, man. Oh,
Tom, yes.
I'm guessing that, you know, really you're talking more about AM sites because, you know, from a financial point of view, so many AM stations are in pretty bad shape. They're just limping along or losing money. And so there's not money to take care of this. But, you know, like you said earlier, hey, if you own a house and you let the paint rot on the outside of the house, pretty soon you're going to get insects and wood rot and all kinds of problems and an ingress, especially your roof. I mean, I think of maintaining a tower a bit like maintaining your roof. If you get a hole in the roof, you know, in a year or two, you can kiss the rest of the house goodbye because it's going to get awful.
You bet. And one of the scariest things that you can see is to walk up to the base of that tower, to your point before, you don't want bad news. And to see the insulator on an AM that's either cracked or broken. And, you know, I've had one of those in the station. I brought it to the station owner's attention, and I always put this stuff in writing because that way no one can say I didn't tell you. And it's like, look, we got to get this taken care of. Well, I have insurance. Well, that's nice. This is a four-legged tower, and if that insulator goes down and completely shatters and the tower comes down and it falls in that direction, yeah, okay, it's on your property. It's not a big deal as far as liability goes. But it's probably not going to do that. It's probably going to take one or more of the other insulators with it. There's a house next door. What's going to happen when that falls through their bedroom or their kid's bedroom at night? I mean, I can't imagine. And at least in one case, it was an AM tower, but on that tower there was an FM antenna for the FM co-located, and there was an STL dish for the other FM station that's, you know, about 20 miles away. You're going to have three stations off the air. Now what?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And that kind of liability is real scary, too. Hey, I want to quick circle back to something you guys said earlier about weeds. And, of course, if the weeds are up that high where they're touching the antenna, you know you're not taking care of the place. And, yeah, I know what happens. I've had a tower or two in Mississippi where the weeds grow a foot a day. Sometimes it's hard to keep them down. You know, we use Pramitol and Triox and Roundup if we have to keep those things down. There was a story, in fact, it was a video on YouTube from a Russian AM radio station where it was very quiet out at the transmitter site, and the guy was recording with his camera, and you could hear the radio station. And it wasn't RF getting into the cell phone. It was the weeds were demodulating. There was the, were arcing and demodulating the radius. You know how sometimes the coils in the tuning house will sing, right? You can hear the radio station in those coils. Well, you could hear them against the weeds. So they had weed demodulators for their AM station.
Kind of like a crystal radio set, except you're using weeds instead.
Yes, exactly. And if it's gotten to that, point, man, it's too far. I guess that's what's, you know, Tom, you've described some stations that are almost too far gone. It's going to take either a huge expenditure or a catastrophic failure, and perhaps a could be a human disaster as well, for something to get done. It seems as though, you know, the time to take action on some stations that you're familiar with would have been 5, 8, 10 years ago, when things were starting to deteriorate. And we can all, well, I've seen situations like that, and it's sad. It's not our purse strings. It's not our money. All we can do is inform and warn, and you know, let the person who actually has the liability live with that if that's what they have to do.
Right. And you know, getting back to the weeds for a second, let's say summer goes by and now you're into fall, and those weeds dry out, and those weeds are there, and those weeds are still touching the tower. Well, now comes the first frost, and now you get some ice. That makes a nice, nifty short circuit on that tower, and all of a sudden your AM is off the air, and you don't know why. You've got these things growing up around the transmission line if it's an FM. Mm-hmm. They could move it out of the way. If there are ground straps attached, it could snap the ground straps. And that can cause other issues depending on the site and what's involved. So, you know, and you're right. I mean, to use another analogy, think of your car. If you don't change the oil on the car, eventually that engine's going to seize. And, yeah. You know, the time to get to it is a lot of manufacturers nowadays are saying 7,500 miles. With synthetic oil, I tend to do 5,000 miles. And I'm religious about it. 5,000 miles comes up, that oil gets changed. If I'm going on a trip and surpassing 5,000 miles on the trip, that oil gets changed before I leave. And I haven't lost an engine. So, you know, the time when the engine starts acting up is not the time to go, gee, maybe I should change the oil.
Hey, let's think for a second about before we go to our mid break here. Tom, what's your experience in the rustability of different tower designs? I've always been a fan of solid leg towers, although I know in many cases a tubular leg tower can be more rigid than a solid leg tower. But we're not talking about rigidity here. We're talking about resistance to rust. I've seen too many inexpensive or, you know, smaller scale hollow leg towers rust out because they get moisture inside them that you don't know about. Then there's the other kind of tower, the flat iron or angle iron towers, the old wind charger towers. Are there still some of those up? Talk to me about what you've observed with different types of tower design construction.
Well, one of the other issues with the tubular leg is if you get water into that leg or into a cross member and it freezes, you can rupture that member. All of a sudden, you've got a big crack on top or bottom or the side or whatever. And that's obviously going to weaken it. Like you, I'm a big fan of the solid, solid legs. The one tower I saw once that was kind of scary. This tower was iron, not steel. And back in the day, it was great. But this was another company I worked for. It was out at one of their stations, which I mean, literally two blocks away. There was the Pacific Ocean. So you're in a salt air environment with an iron tower. Now steel rusts, but in the case of steel, the tower crews tell me that the rust actually makes the tower stronger because at some point it's going to stop. With rust, it just keeps going. And that tower that I'm talking about. Let's say the tower leg was about as big around as my thumb. Well, here it was 40 years later. It was now that big around. And if you looked up the tower, it did this. It came up and it went. And it did one of those numbers and came up. And yeah, they could probably fix that with guy wires. And the tower crew looked at it and went, nope. Not doing it. Not going to happen. Not going near it. Not going to pull on it. Have a nice day. So.
Wow. So do you still see any of those flat iron towers, the wind chargers? I think that was a brand name, right?
Well, Windcharger was a brand name. Actually, I'm not sure who makes the towers. I've got a transmitter site in Queens that has four towers, and most of the members on that tower are flat. Mm-hmm. And we're talking big towers. They're flat member, and they look in good condition. But then again, this site has been taken care of over the years, so it's due for a paint job now. It's getting to that point where it's time to paint, but it's by no means bad. And I had a tower crew go up to look at a light a while back, and they just looked at the thing. They said, "Dude, this tower is great." And the tower had been put up, I think, in the late 1920s, early 1930s.
Wow. Even better, because I was going to mention the famous tower here in Nashville, WSM, and it's almost 900 feet tall. It's all flat iron and angles. And 1937 is when it was put up, and it's in great shape, but it's been taken care of. The air castle of the South, it's got great paint on it, and it's had members replaced and when things got ugly. So, Chris, in your part of the world, you used to visit some AM towers, and I think you said they're generally kept in pretty good shape. It's number one market, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the AM sites I've been at have been in great shape. There's been a few in the outskirts that suffered a little bit, but nothing to the degree of what Tom is describing and some I've witnessed. They're all in pretty good shape, and a lot of them were up erected in the late 30s, 40s, and they're still cranking away. Yeah, but they've been well maintained. If you talk to tower crews, and they can tell you, oh yeah, that site had this, we did that work about 10 years ago, and that site had this, we did work 20 years ago, and yeah, they're maintained. I mean, hey, I've been on top of some rooftops of buildings that have small towers for FMs, and they're in worse shape than some of the AM sites I've been at. So, it's not only AMs that can suffer, but FMs do too. And FMs have their share. And what's sad, though, is the FMs, sometimes it's hidden or it's not as obvious until you really look close or, unfortunately, something bad happens. But, no matter how you look at it, Tom, any tower, AM or FM, needs maintenance. And you can't excuse it.
Tom referred earlier to, hey, you can do an inspection with a drone. At least you can get an idea if there's anything just horrible going on up there. And plenty of engineers are playing with those. We had Sam Wallington on our show a few weeks ago. And I've made a number of, I'm not going to call them inspections because I'm not a structural guy. I'm not a tower guy. Sure, I could see if something is really ugly in terms of rust. But drones are a good way to make an inspection before the tower crew shows up and say, hey, everything looks good up to 600 feet. Pay special attention to, right under this bay or something. So, and then, of course,
lines.
A drone could be used afterwards, too.
Yeah, transmission lines, that's the best thing for the drones.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Transmission lines. And
times,
we saw
how many times you get calls that you hear a noise, there's a problem, or you have a leak. Oh, your sparks and the transmission line separated from the tower, the hangars.
Hey, you've seen? Did you see the one the other day on Facebook, Chris? I forget who posted it. It was a section that was on the bottom end of the antenna, and it had three big holes in it.
Yes, it wasn't holding any air.
Yeah.
It looked like Swiss cheese. Hey, so we've been talking about towers. We're going to, after our break here, we're going to talk a little bit about guy wires and guy anchors because those are important too. And a lot of times if a tower comes down, it wasn't necessarily a failure of the structure of the tower. It was the failure of a guy wire, a guy anchor point, or a Kellum's grip, or an insulator, something like that that's part of the guy wire system. So we're going to be talking about that when we come back and Tom can enlighten us about what he sees out there. I'll bet you plenty of trees and brush, intertwined with that. Not good for guy wires. This Week in Radio Tech, episode 358, is brought to you by our friends at Broadcast Supply Worldwide. That's BSWUSA.com. And right now, the remote sale is going on at BSWUSA.com. You can save up to 43% on a wide range of remote broadcasting gear. Maybe something that you need or have always wished for. This is from top manufacturers, too, of course. They have a pre-order special going on right now on this brand new Comrex Access NX. So you've been familiar with the Comrex Access. It's been around for quite a few years. Great little box to do remotes with, and they've kept improving it as time goes on. Well, the new Access NX is going to be available pretty soon. And if you order it now, you pre-order it, you get an Audio-Technica BPH-S1 headset
You get those together for an extra low price. It's got faster processors, powerful error correction, and a very handy touchscreen. It's really worth checking out. They got Portal PA packages. Hey, if you're out on remote at the car dealer, at the county fair, at a baseball game, you might need some PA to talk to the crowd. Well, those are on sale as well. Plenty of remote packages, too. You can get a whole package outfitted just the way you like it, and that can be on sale. There's a special going on the B-Stock version. Now, so these have been either gently used or demoed of the JK Audio Remote Mix 4. That's a four-channel field mixer. It's perfect in so many ways. Factory sealed, comes with a full warranty, and it is under $1,100 for this mixer, which is a heck of a good price. I mean, it is broadcast worthy. It's going to last you for years and years. Plenty of headsets are on sale as well. And here's something cool, the HDV mixer. Now, they have a sports video package as more and more radio stations get into streaming video. Folks want to see that. And, you've already got the audio. You've already got your play-by-play, your color guy, your commentator on the field, your coach interview. Now you can incorporate video of those things. And Chris Tobin has mentioned that so many times, where they've been innovative in getting video to go along with their audio, or use their audio on a new video, and made a really special feature of that, made it worthwhile for advertisers and for viewers and fans alike. Well, the HDV mixer seamlessly integrates video from two cameras, lower thirds, graphics, social media interactions can be on screen as well. It runs on the included laptop computer to give you plenty of elbow room and tight press boxes. You got to check this thing out. It is cool, and I believe that for radio stations that do, you know, high school football, college football, college, I'm sure there's rights involved, maybe with high school too, but check those out. Get those rights and put those ball games on the air. You will really increase the value that you're supplying to your advertisers. And your parents, oh, they're going to love it. Absolutely. Coaches will too, and so will the school. The whole remote sale is on right now at bswusa.com. Check them out. And we're so delighted that they're a sponsor. If you would tell them that you heard about it on Twerk, that'd be great. Remember, bswusa.com. You order something by 7 p.m. Eastern time. If it's in their big warehouse in Ohio, which almost everything is, they can have it on a plane that night. If you need it overnight, need it the next day, that's the key right there, bswusa.com. All right, we're talking to Tom Ray, coming to us from – Tom, where are you? You're in a studio somewhere.
Well, I'm in the studio of 95.3 The Wolf, WLFK, in Ogdensburg, New York. I'll tell you where Ogdensburg is in a minute. The hall for me is WQTK 92.7 and WSLB, which is ESPN Radio for the North Country. I am located, it's not quite as far north, but almost about as far north as you can get in New York State. Literally 5 minutes, not even five, it's a 5-minute walk from here, and I can be on the bridge to Canada.
Well, and has anybody suggested you go there?
Yes, many. And as a matter of fact, it was funny. On the way over here to the studio today, I stopped at the transmitter, which is in Gouverneur, New York, which is down Route 11, about 23 miles from here. And there's a cutover that comes over this way. It's kind of a shortcut. Otherwise, you have to go up to Canton and cut over, and it's a pain. But anyway, and there was a sign there as you approach this cutoff, and it's green, and it has yellow letters, and it's got a big arrow, and it says, you know, Canada this way with a big maple leaf. Well, it looks like that billboard, the lease is up on it, so they have a big banner across it. This is for rent, so it goes, Canada, for rent. And I said, that's great. I can rent Canada. When we're done here, I'm going to go find the place so I can go rent Canada. I think this is great.
I hear it. People are very polite there.
We need Jeff Welton on.
All right. Before we run out of time, we got a couple of topics still to cover. Guy Wires, because Guy Wires and Guy Anchor Points. And hey, within the next few weeks, Dave Anderson is going to be back on the show, because Dave has some recent experience with actually replacing and refurbishing guy anchors down in the ground where this became necessary. Yeah, they dug out all around, and I'm not sure what all they did. That's why Dave's going to be on. But Tom, talk to us about guy anchor maintenance and how it is every bit as important as the tower itself. And hey, there's more of them. They're easier, and they're just seems like they're easier to let go. They're not a focus of your attention like the tower is.
Yeah, they're kind of out of sight, out of mind. But the one thing to remember about guy wires, their purpose is not necessarily to hold the tower up. they're to keep the tower from falling down, because the tower is actually engineered without certain external forces to stand up straight. When the wind blows, when a bird lands on it, when something happens, that tower is going to pull, and the guy wire pulls it back. So they're extremely important to keep that tower upright. Guy anchors, first things first, trees like to grow around them. They're usually at the far end of the field, and trees grow up and get into the guy wires. And that's one of the worst things you can have happen, because, you know, the guy wires have to move. They have to be able to stretch. The trees not only prevent that from happening, but the trees also can cause trouble with the integrity of the guy wire, and you don't want it to fail at that point. Chris was right before when he said, you know, they should be fenced. You don't want somebody going in and saying, oh, what does this do, and loosen a turnbuckle. You don't want somebody getting in there and saying, hey, let's have some fun, and decide to try to climb up the guy wire. However, I have seen some tower crews, some guy wires need to be greased, and I have seen some guys, they have this thing that they actually ride it down. And No. I like my feet on the ground. But it depends on the guy wire, depends on what it's made out of. Some of them need to be greased. I have had guy wires painted, so some actually have to be painted. And every several years, the tower crew should, I think it's called a tensometer. They put it on the guy wire down near the guy anchor, and they check the actual tension on the guy wire to make sure everything is tensioned properly. While they're checking to make sure the tower is straight, not only just in general, but at every point where the guy wire is, and they make sure everything lines up and they adjust the tension. So, you're not pulling the tower in one particular direction when you're not supposed to, or, you know, you don't have one that's too loose. So if the wind blows, you know, if you're in almost a hurricane condition, you don't want that tower in the middle to be moving out, because next thing you know, you're going to weaken something. It could come down.
I would point out that, I've seen this happen before, when your guy tensions on a particular guy wire, of course, it affects them all. If one gets loose, it tends to loosen the others because the tower shifts a little bit. But if the guy tensions are loose, maybe it's because the guy anchor moved. Maybe it got dragged through the mud. And maybe where you live, you don't have this problem. But in the muddy Mississippi River Delta area, you know, the fields are just awful. You've got it's possible to move that concrete, even if they supposedly did it right.
Up here in the north, you've got frost heaves.
Frost heaves. What happened?
Down around the New York City area, we tend to have a footing that goes about 42 inches down. That's where the frost line is. That's below frost line. Up here in North Country, in January and February, it gets down to 30 below at night. So the frost level is like 5 or 6 feet down. Which also, it's very interesting. My daughter went to school not from this location here. They had a program at the school for mortuary science. And up here in the North Country, if someone's going to be buried, they have to wait till spring. They can't open the ground. That's how cold. That's how hard the ground gets.
Wow. So, Chris, I'm sorry.
You know.
Yeah. Oh, Chris, no, I think I was going to say something about guy anchor depth.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, no, the guy anchor depth. Yeah, I mean. Yeah, in muddy conditions, or there's a chance. I was going to say frost heave. I was doing some work with a friend on a campsite up in Bethel, New York, and they were talking about putting anchors in for one of the buildings. And I was asking him, I said, where do you start? He goes, oh, right here, about 4 feet. And if we're lucky, otherwise we probably go down about 5. Otherwise, we'll find it back up on top of the ground by the spring. you know, so little things you take it. You know, yeah. Like, and it's up on a mountain, and there's ledge, and there's rock, you know, the ledge rock and all the other stuff. So it was the wildest experience, I have to say. I had a good time. Also, speaking of the guy anchors and what their purpose, don't forget, the reason you need to check on them, and Tom is right, you want to check the tensions at some point during the life of the tower and check the anchor positions, make sure they're still where they should be. But also, the guy anchor system is meant to pull the tower down within itself. So if there should be a catastrophic failure, a mechanical failure, a structural failure, that is, of the tower structure, say a cross member fails because of weather or who knows what, or something strikes the tower. The idea is the guy anchors the cabling is to pull it down into itself, and that's part of the design. Usually, as Tom mentioned earlier, that he had a site that, you know, there are people living near the perimeter of the property, and if the guy anchors aren't working right, the guy, the tower is structured, everything else, there's a potential. That's part of the design. Now, it doesn't always, you know, it's not always 100%, but that's part of the design. That's another reason for preventive maintenance, checking on these things. It's a fascinating science, and Tom knows all too well because he lives it every day, and people take for granted a lot of things. And the tower structure, as Tom pointed out, does move. I've been up on towers of 300 feet, and they're guide towers, and I can tell you, they're moving, and your body feels it, and your inner ear, your sense of motion and stability. You're like, oh wow, what is that feeling? And it's like the wildest thing. And I've been on buildings. I mean, I was on what building? I was on a building here in the city, and on top of a tower structure on a building. And one day it was really windy, and there was a little motion. I could see on the level. I had a level on the tower structure. I'm like, that's moving. That's interesting. So you'd be surprised at all these different sciences that go into a tower design for both AM and FM.
And I worked at a station once. We had self-supporting Truscan towers, you know, old, put up in the mid-30s. 330 feet. Anyway, if you had a real bad storm come in and it was windy, you could watch the thing and you could actually see the top of the tower moving. And you know, somebody from the office got scared one day and they came in. They said, yeah, the tower's going to break. I said, no, it's not. It's got to do that. If it doesn't do that, it will break.
Yeah, yeah, there is expected motion. You have to have a little bit, just like, you know, they're building the CNN Hudson Yards Tower here in New York City, and that building will move several feet. When the old World Trade Center, we have the new Trade Center, but the old World Trade Center, Twin Towers. I remember when I was up there on the rooftop, they moved, I think it was about 3 feet. You could put a glass of water on a table, you know, at 110th floor, 105th floor, and you can watch it move back and forth. There were people, a friend of mine, he worked for a financial firm. He worked up in the tower, and I remember him telling me they used to have Dramamine pills for folks, for those who didn't had sensitivity to motion. That's how much motion there is. Can you picture a building structure moving of that distance, and then on top of it, a 200, 300-foot tower structure for antennas? Just the thing, as Tom pointed out, that self-supporting tower at the top is moving. It's just it's a science that I think we take for granted.
Its base is moving. Wow.
Is it the Chase Tower there in Chris that has the in Manhattan that has the damping on one of the floors is just concrete blocks on tracks that move back and forth to slow down the sway?
Yes, the building known as the Citicorp building, which is now called something Lexington Avenue because it's no longer Citicorp. But yes, the building with the slant. It's the building in the Manhattan skyline that has the slant. That is the Citicorp building at 53rd and Lex, and there is a mass dampening unit. I've been up there. I've seen it. I've taken pictures of it, so I have a record of it. And it's the wildest-looking, huge metal slab. I mean, is it like 30 feet by 40 feet? It's huge. And it slides on a film of oil, and it has a cantilever arm that moves back and forth. And it's meant to dampen the motion of the building. It was done early on in the construction. It was discovered that the building, the way it's designed, if you ever look at the bottom near the street level, you'll notice that it's got four corners, but one of the corners doesn't really have a leg on it. And the way it's designed, so it's meant to counter the motion. Yes, mass dampening device. It's the wildest thing to look at. I've been up there a couple of times for radio work, and and I just go up in that room. It's like I tell the building engineer, I was like, hey, can we stop it? He goes, yeah, come on, let's go. Just to be able to go in and look at it and go, wow. This is the wildest thing to see. This it's like, and it doesn't move. We're not talking it moves 6 feet at a time. It's like this tiny little motion, but it's the weight. It's just massive. I have to dig up the pictures, but it's the it. You know, if you're into science of any kind or the physics and you know, fluid dynamics and mechanical dynamics, to see this and then to be told by the people who maintain it what it's doing, and then you look it up online, you go, oh, whoa, and just it's just the wildest thing. It's funny. Yes, Tom, that is the Citicorp.
There's an article about that building at slate.com, And the original artist design for this building is scary. I think they beefed it up and made it less architecturally interesting. But there's a whole article about that and an audio report too. So we might put that in the show notes. That sounds pretty interesting. Woo. But there's some sales advantages when you're selling condos at the top of one of these buildings. You can fill up your bathtub and you got a like a wave pool right there. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Hey, I worked in a building. I worked, I worked at a building on 7th Avenue and 57th Street. It was a 55-story building. And on windy days, if you're in the bathroom, the men's room, you can hear the building creak. We're only on the 10th floor, and we could hear a creak. Imagine what it was like at the top. And then in the early days of the building, when they didn't understand the twisting of physical structures in the wind, the windows would pop out. Think of it.
Ooh.
Twist it. What happens? So to be in a building and on a windy, stormy day, to hear it creaking while you're sitting in the water closet, it's the wildest thing. And for those who don't get it, we used to have visitors that would come to the radio station and go, "Is there a bathroom here?" I'm like, "Yeah." And it's windy and raining and the thunderstorm's rolling through. I'm like, "Oh, how long is it going to take before they panic?" They go in, wait in the lobby. They come out, look on their face like, there's a noise in the bathroom. I said, "Oh, good. I'm glad. That's a good sign." "What do you mean?" "That's the building moving because it's raining. It's windy outside." "What?"
And I said, "Well, I think I can hold it just fine."
The other thing is elevators in skyscrapers and in tall buildings have to be adjusted for speed because guess what? The elevator track also bends.
Yeah.
So if you've ever been in an elevator room on the top of a large building and say, "Why are these wind speed devices and other things up here?" That's to tell the motor system not to be speeding up when the building is swaying a certain way.
On the other hand, being in the bathroom when you hear that building creaking is the perfect place to be.
That's true. It's a set of four.
Okay. So what time did we lose control of the podcast?
Come on. It's not losing control. It's part of, if you're a radio station or TV facility in a skyscraper, these are things as a station engineer understand because, that's part of the design.
Sure. Yeah. Man.
In some parts of the country, if you're only three stories high, you won't have this problem.
We've got just a little time left. So we're going to do our final quick break. Tom, since you're out in the field a lot, seeing real radio stations and real problems, why don't you kind of give it, when we come back, your tip of the week? Would you make it about something that you see a lot of and people need to think about correcting it or some other tip? But that might be a good place to go with that tip. And Chris, I think we were going to talk for just a minute about the Hammond organ
Let me during the break, I'll get into position and see if we can have some fun.
All right. Our show this week in Radio Tech is brought to you by my friends at the Telos Alliance. Oh, look, I'm wearing the shirt. Well, they pay my salary, so I'm delighted that they're around. And the new audio processor, the Omnia Volt. Check it out now.
More top radio stations choose Omnia than all other competing processors combined. Now meet the Omnia Volt, sharing lineage with Omnia processors like the Omnia 11, electrifying, competitive, market-leading audio in a compact one-rack unit package. With Omnia Heritage built in, the Omnia Volt includes Dynamics Magic from Omnia chief algorithm designer Cornelius Gould, including 6 AGC sections from start to finish, deep bass, warmth, and stereo enhancers, 5-band time-align limiter, the world's best presets to get you started right, and spectrally pristine final processing designed by Frank Foti. OmniaVolt users love its Quick Tweak feature. Quick Tweak distills years of processing knowledge and proven approaches into simple controls that turn you into a processing pro. Nail your signature sound in minutes using advanced presets or your own settings right from the Volt's front panel or a PC. OmniaVolt brings charisma to your station's audio. FM translators and low-power FM stand out among the crowd. AM stations maximize clarity and coverage. Digital broadcasts sound clear and musical without fatiguing artifacts. Smart design, clearly visible outside and inside. Input and output connections in analog, AES-3, Livewire, and multiplex for FM. Automatic input selection handles redundant STLs.
Remote control works with today's browsers, tablets, and smartphones. Idealized patch point for external watermarking. And hardened construction to withstand lightning strikes, surges, high RF fields, and harsh conditions.
The new Omnia Volt is stunning. Everyone will know you've got an Omnia on your station.
Omnia Volt is versatile too. DSP Core firmware alters the personality of Volt to fit your changing needs. FM, AM, digital transmission, or studio processing. Volt can even be used as a standalone stereo generator. DSP cores aren't extra cost add-ons. Download the functionality you need for free. The Omnia Volt. Omnia audio processing for any station. And a smart upgrade for aspiring broadcasters. Proven audio processing that'll leave your competitors in the dust.
That is an amazing processor. The successor to the Omnia One, the new Omnia Volt. Check it out, and I would just like to say that, remember, the Omnia Volt was designed after the Omnia 11 was designed. So there's some heritage right in there. You need to check it out. Great processor, AM, FM, HD, studio, all that stuff. Thanks to Omnia for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, let's see if Tom Ray might be able to fill us in. Tom, you see a lot of radio stations that want to stay out of trouble, and you probably advise them on what to do. What you got for us?
No, I help them get into trouble, but no. I'm going to shift gears slightly away from towers. One thing I see a lot of is with automation systems, there's no backup. There's no backup files. There's no backup hard drive. There's no backup server. You really need to take your files, your audio files, and put them someplace, because it's not if, it's when that computer's going to crash and that hard drive's going to fail. And if you have everything backed up on a regular basis, you can just load it back in and off you go, which sure as heck beats sitting around the production room loading every commercial and song back into the system while you're off the air.
Well, you are right about that. There's all kinds of solutions for backup now. Even if you don't have an image backup, I mean, you may still have to reinstall Windows or whatever the operating system is. You may have to reinstall the stuff. But, man, those commercials, you're right. All those songs and those commercials that you spend so long putting in, years could be, you need to have a backup of that. And that's very doable with inexpensive solutions.
Yeah, and people don't think of that, but you need to back up all the audio files, and you need to back up the configuration files, because once you reinstall Windows and the automation software, you put your configuration files back in, you're back to where you were.
Gotcha. All right. And hey, your automation manufacturer may be a good place to find out, okay, what do you recommend for a backup solution so that I can most easily rebuild this machine if I have to? And I'm sure some of the better manufacturers will have some good advice there that they've been
through. And I mean, think about it. You can buy a terabyte hard drive today or a 2 terabyte hard drive for under $200.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of money. It's really not for a peace of mind.
All right. And with that, Chris Tobin has been practicing playing the organ. Chris?
haven't been practicing just yet. All right. So as you can see, the Hammond organ, and in this area here is the two switches I was speaking about. Let me see if I can check. Yeah, there you go. See those two little black spots there. There you go. So
one starts the turbine?
The one on the left. So let me turn up the gain on the microphone. I'm going to talk away because I'm not sure how well this will transpose. Can you still hear me? Yes.
Yes.
Good. All right. Here we go. You hear that?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not hearing anything else. It's coming up to speed.
Which one's the choke, Chris? No, never mind.
There we go. Let's see if that'll work. Oh, my goodness. There we go.
I'm not hearing it.
Not hearing it?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm serious. We're not hearing it.
Okay.
How strange.
It's outside the audio passband of the mic.
Yeah, right. Let's see.
Ah.
How about now?
Yeah, hear that. Barely.
Barely. Interesting. All right. Well, it's loud here.
I think the mic likes your voice more than the organ.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's let me see if there's anything I'm missing here. I don't think so.
Ah, there you go.
Well, there you have it. That's a Hammond organ, C3.
Today's sermon by Chris Tobin.
But that organ is used in so many music genres: rock and roll, jazz, church music, right?
Yes. Yeah, we had someone here recently. He actually every Sunday in Brooklyn is an organist. I'm not sure they're using a Hammond, but they definitely have an air organ of some type. So a pipe organ, I guess it should be called. So yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So useful in the studio. And you also have a good sized piano in the studio, right? Or a different studio?
Yes, we do. Hang on.
Oh.
A Steinway. Baby Grand. Uh-huh. Baby Grand.
Nice. Nice.
That dates back to 1983, I believe, was purchased.
All right. Well, next week when we come back, Chris Tobin will be giving us a recital on the Hammond organ. Yes, I'm practicing the new button.
And playing numerous genres of music, including rock, funk, and he'll be singing in church on Sunday.
That's right. There you go. Got it all. Chris Tobin, the singing engineer. All right. Hey, guys, we got to go. I appreciate this talk about towers and, I guess if your tower's too far gone, it's too far gone. That's what I think. But get to it before it's too far gone. Tom Ray, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I appreciate you taking an hour out of your day to be with us.
Hey, it was fun. It's fun to be back. I just wish I could do it more often because at least today it was easy to do. But a lot of times I never know where I'm going to be or how far up to my armpits I'm going to be. So
I'm very glad it worked out. Thank you very much. Chris Tobin, thank you for joining us from the music room at WBGO.
No problem. We talked about miking instruments and what do you do as an engineer for a station. These are the things you come across. Who knew?
Good deal. Hey, we've got some interesting shows coming up for you. I'll have to tell you about it later because we're out of time right now. Next week, I'll be doing the show live from Cleveland, Ohio. From the headquarters of Telos, and I'm not sure what our topic's going to be, but it may be about, we may get some updates on AES 67 and how that is integrating into the world of video, because the video is has selected AES 67 as part of a SMPTE standard to be that way. And that's great. That's great for radio because the more other industries or other sections of our industry support the standards that we're using in radio, the more they're going to be around, the more equipment's going to be there, the bigger choices you'll have, and the more support you'll have. So I think that's important. So I'm going to try to get Greg Shea to be on our show and talk about AES 67 in some new SMPTE standards for television. All right, we got to go. Thanks a lot to Suncast for producing our show. Thanks to our sponsors, Lavo, also BSWUSA.com, and the Telos Alliance and the Omnia Volt. Appreciate all of you very much. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.